Blog Talk Radio.
Tuesday evening event. I'm so thrilled that you're choosing to join us this evening as we're ready to really open up the portal of probably the most profound leading-edge science discoveries with regard to our cells and cell generation principles and what that means for the evolution of humanity and the planet. And everyone who knows me knows that it doesn't take much to excite me, especially when I'm passionate about something. And tonight, I'm actually practically ready to burst at being able to present our special featured guest, Dr. Bruce Lipton, to you. And we're going to delve in deep with Dr. Lipton on this new evolution of epigenetics. And I must add that he's probably the most energetic and dynamic speaker I've listened to. And just something brief, because we'd rather be speaking to Bruce and find out all about what he's doing instead of giving a huge intro. But just to let you know, his scientific career started as a cell biologist and received his PhD degree from the University of Virginia at Charlottesville before joining the Department of Anatomy at the University of Wisconsin School of Medicine in 1973. And Bruce is a true pioneer, and his research on muscular dystrophy studies employing cloned human stem cells focused on the molecular mechanisms controlling cell behavior. So Dr. Bruce Lipton is also an internationally recognized authority in merging science and spirit, and as a result of his discoveries, internalized them and came into his own transformation. So a warm-spirited welcome, Dr. Lipton, and a gracious thank you for being with us this evening.
Susie, thank you. Thank you for all that. I hope I didn't scare people away with molecular things and stuff like that, but we have some very wonderful things to talk about that are not as scary as, like, molecules and things.
Okay, great. Great. I guess the first thing that I need to ask, and, you know, as a child, I was very much into biology and science, and then I got into spirit, and then I always wished that at some point in time the two would converge because I knew there was something connected there. So I know that scientists always have questions. I think that's why they enter the field of science. And I just was curious to what led you to this magnificent discovery.
Well, it actually really started on one day in my life when I was in second grade. And the science teacher brought in a microscope and put on it a little stuff from pond water, which had some amoebas and, you know, algae and some paramecia and stuff like that. And that was, the class lined up, and we all had a chance to look in the microscope. And when I had my opportunity, I looked in there. I was so blown away as a kid because I saw these cells moving around. And in my own child's mind, I said, they look like this. To me, they were like miniature people in a sense, living in their world. And, you know, being a small kid, anything smaller than you is, you feel really more powerful in the kid's world. So it was like, wow, there's this miniature world that I was observing. And I was intrigued by that and spent the summer, I got a little microscope and spent so much time on the microscope and spent time trying to actually take pictures through this little kid's microscope with an old Brownie Hawkeye camera. Spent a whole summer doing that, and at the end of the summer, I finally figured out, and I got a picture, and it was like a whole summer spent on that, and I'm sure my father lost a lot of hair on all the film that I kept just taking it in every day, and because I didn't understand about where you actually hold the camera, so it was a learning event But that was in, you know, I was in second grade at that time. And whatever number of years it was later, by the time I got out of college, I was in graduate school, this time looking through electron microscopes. And so that thing that started in second grade propelled me right into graduate school, where I was studying cell biology. And the electron microscope is like the most exciting instrument I've ever worked with, in the sense that you go into this very dark room, and then there's this big console, looks like a like Star Trek kind of thing, and there's all kinds of pumping noises and gauges and stuff like that, and you put in a specimen into this column, a big steel column that rises up to the ceiling, and you turn on the microscope, and first you can see the cells at very low magnification, and then you turn it up higher and higher, and then you're looking into the cells and then through the cells and into the molecules of the cells. And so I had this great career of being like a inner space explorer. It always surprised me, because I used to do this work, and it was so exciting, because every day I would go into the laboratory and I would see things that no human had ever seen before, because of the option of using this microscope. They can magnify things a million times. And so it was sort of like, it's like reverse astronomy. As much as the Hubble looks out in deep space, the electron microscope looks into inner space. And there are different worlds. So obviously, it was very intriguing. It was just like going to Star Trek every day and getting paid for it. So that was great. But it led me to my research, and what I was doing was cloning stem cells. And now people think that stem cells are something like, oh, that's just recent in our history, the stem cell stuff. But I was actually cloning stem cells back in 1967. That was like 40 some years ago. And the relevance about this is, I was growing these communities of cells and studying them. But what was most interesting, the experiment that changed my life and transformed me, had to deal with a question of what was controlling the fate of my stem cells. Stem cells are cells that have a lot of potentials, and they can become bone cells or skin cells or brain cells or whatever kind of cells. And so the question was, what is it that takes a stem cell and makes it a special cell? So here's what the experiment was all about, but first let me give this other part. While I was doing this research at the University of Wisconsin, I was teaching medical school, and I was teaching them the standard curriculum about the nature of genetic control. And we were teaching a belief that genes control our traits and characteristics, our behaviors and emotions and things like that, a concept that was called genetic determinism, meaning something, genes determine your traits. That was the belief system. And,
right.
And people still believe that in the world today, except for leading edge science. Of course, this is not true at all. But the problem is, and we'll get to it, is that the public is not informed of this. But what I was teaching was that we're more or less, people are more or less biochemical machines controlled by genes. And in teaching that, we also taught the fact that the genes controlled the characters. Well, then why that was relevant is, if you go back and you ask yourself, well, did I pick the genes that I came with? We don't know, probably not. And the other question is, well, if genes control my traits, can I change the genes that I don't like? And you start to realize, well, A, you didn't pick the genes, and B, you can't change the genes, and the genes control your characters and traits and things like Alzheimer's or cancer or whatever people want to talk about running in families. Then you all of a sudden start to get an image of a human as a victim. A victim of forces outside of their control, genes controlling their lives and they not being able to select or control their genes. So it's basically victims of genes. And when we teach this, it's very important, because what does the public take away as a lesson from that kind of teaching? The first thing you take away is, well, if genes control my life and I can't control them and I can't change them, then that's my fate, and it's already locked in my genes, and I just have to live with this terrible fate of maybe getting cancer or diabetes or whatever is running in the family, and it's just like it's out of your control. And then we need a rescuer, because we believe, well, we're a victim now, and what we want is somebody to save us from these genes, these ruthless genes that run our lives. And so we buy into a profession that says, yeah, well, look, you're a biochemical machine, and when you're in a state of dis-ease, and basically your machine's not running right, and in the same manner that an auto mechanic can take a car into the shop and put it on the lift and do a diagnosis and adjust it, medicine was somewhat based on the same principle. You bring your, you know, body, your vehicular body, into the examining room, and then as the doctor who is now looking at all the, you know, the stats, the diagnosis, to see what's wrong with your machine, and then to say, well, okay, now we see what's wrong with the machine, we're going to have to give you some new parts, new chemicals, new drugs to control this runaway machine. And so you're basically still sitting in the doctor's office, a victim, waiting for somebody to fix you. So I'm teaching this. This is called basic medical science. And then go ahead, Susie.
No, I know the programs that you're talking about with regard to, you know, what we've been, these record collections that we have about, you know, well, I inherited it. And, I mean, you think about all the women that are now going for this genetic testing.
Oh,
and
don't waste your money. Don't waste the money.
No, but I mean, what's even more disturbing than that about the money is that they're actually volunteering because of genetic testing of their relatives and, you know,
yes,
females, that they're actually going in and having their breasts removed.
It's interesting. Yeah, ooh, scares me.
Yes, without even them having any of these, you know, just because they carry the gene. But there's nothing wrong with them, and that's just so heartbreaking.
Well,
so,
you
go
know,
on.
It's unfortunately because you code it with you know, like doctor talk, and it's a process. It's a thing called a mastectomy, and we're going to go do this, and it sounds so sterile and clean with all the white cloth around it and everything. And here's an honest truth: it's called mutilation because there wasn't any reason to do it at that point. Number one,
exactly,
and other than the fear. And why this becomes relevant is that we now recognize that most cancers are not actually caused by genes, but they're caused by lifestyle. And lifestyle in this case means your personal beliefs and attitudes and emotions and how you're running your life are the primary cause. It runs in families, as we're going to talk about hopefully real soon, is because behavior is transmitted from parent to child almost as efficiently as genes are transmitted, and yet the genes and behavior are not the same thing. Oh, we're ahead of my story. Okay.
Go ahead. Yes, I'm sorry.
So we're teaching victimization and fears, like, okay, you got these genes in your family, so you better get ready, and you know, we have all these procedures, et cetera. And while I'm doing that, I'm doing this research on the cell. So I got these stem cell cultures, and what I do is I put one single stem cell in it, let it divide every day. So it was a culture that only had one cell introduced into it, but that cell divides every day, actually twice a day, and by the end of 10 days, 2 weeks, you've got thousands of cells in the petri dish. But here's what's important: every cell in the dish is genetically identical to every other cell because they came from the same parent. So the point about it is this: I have all these genetically identical cells, and I'm doing this experiment where I'm changing the conditions of the culture medium, the fluids I grow the cells in, with slight changes in the environment, such as the chemical elements of the medium, or changing the amount of oxygen versus carbon dioxide in the incubator, just slight adjustments. And here's what happened. When I changed, I had three different environments. Same cells were put into three different plates, and then each plate of the three was put into a different environment, in the sense of different culture medium. And one plate, the cells form muscle. One plate, the cells form bone. And the third plate, the cells form fat cells. Well, that's totally wonderful because I was like, you know, controlling the fate of the cells in this regard. But the issue is, the fundamental question is, what actually controlled the fate of the cells? And at that time, of course, everything was genetics. Genes control everything. But then here's the problem. In each of the cultures, the cells were all genetically identical at the start of the culture. So basically what it says is they all went into the experiment being genetically identical, yet at the end of the experiment they had different fates. And the only thing that was different was the environment. The environment, the culture fluid that the cells were growing in. So by manipulating the culture fluid, I manipulated the fate and activity of the cells. And even more simple than that, I take a culture dish of my healthy cells and put it into an environment that we would say is an unhealthy environment, and the cells start to get sick and they start to die. Well, you'd say, yeah, I expect that kind of thing. But here's what's interesting. All you do is move that plate from that unhealthy environment back into a healthy environment, and the cells immediately recover and become healthy again. Now, so we understand that, you know, basically the cells are responding to the conditions of the environment. So this all of a sudden takes a very profound step if we just jump ahead and tell you a very simple fact. When we look at ourselves in the mirror, we see ourselves as single entities. You know, you look in the mirror, there's Susie looking back at you. I see a mirror, there's Bruce looking back at me. And these are single humans. And the fact is, well, the concept of single is a misperception in this regard. Because we're actually made out of cells. Cells are the living things. It's the inside of the body under the skin are about 50 trillion cells. They're the living entity. So when you look at yourself, because you can't magnify your eyes, the vision enough to see it, you see one human body. But if you magnify it with a microscope closer and closer and look at the body, you see, wait, it's a community of 50 trillion sentient living cells. And so the truth is, we are a community of cells. And just to let people know, one other interesting fact about these little miniature cells is that virtually every cell in your body has every function that you have as a human being, meaning every cell has a digestive, respiratory system, excretory system, nervous system, reproductive system, endocrine system. Every cell even has an immune system. And so there's something very important. We stand back and we say, guess what? You see yourself as one single individual. In truth, you're a community of 50 trillion citizens called cells. And these cells provide all the characters and traits of life. And so we are actually a community. And it's interesting because and the cells that are in there are the equivalent of miniature people, because they have all the same traits and characters as you. They walk into their world. They live in an environment. There's daytime and nighttime in a sense of, 24-hour cycles going on, that they eat food, they digest it, they breathe, they communicate with each other, they move around, they avoid toxins and predators, and, have social relationships. And it's like, wait, underneath your skin are 50 trillion little sentient cells, each like a miniature human living in a community. And yet, here's the fun character. While I was working in the lab with cells in plastic dishes, this is the truth. A human is a skin-covered petri dish with 50 trillion cells inside.
Yeah.
And when you cut yourself and the blood comes out, what you're seeing is the culture medium, which is feeding those 50 trillion cells, okay? And just in exactly the same way that if I change the constituents of my culture medium in my plastic petri dishes, by changing the constituents of the culture medium, I can direct the fate and activities of the cells. Well, guess what? The blood contains the factors and hormones and regulators and all these emotional chemicals that affect the activity and genetic readout of the cells just the same way as culture medium does in a plastic dish. But here's the big shocker in this. I'm the guy in the laboratory mixing up the culture medium and adding it to the petri dishes and changing the constituents. In your skin-covered petri dish, the human brain is the equivalent of a chemist. And what does it do? It reads the environment and sees what's going on, and then adjust the chemistry of the blood just like a chemist in a laboratory, and the signals that are sent into the blood are then sent throughout the body and affect the health and growth and development of the cells in your body. So you are a skin-covered petri dish, and your culture medium is your blood, and your blood chemistry is adjusted by your brain, and it does so in response to your perceptions, your beliefs, your attitudes, and your emotions. Those are the factors that determine the chemistry. So now we stop and we say, wait, old story, teaching medical students, your body's a biochemical machine controlled by genes. It's out of your control. New science. your body is a device made out of a community of 50 trillion cells, that the growth medium of the cells is controlled by the brain, which adjusts the chemistry. Then the relevance about that says, well, then you adjust your chemistry. That means you can change everything in your body. And the fact is, this is exactly what the new science says. We're not controlled by genes. We're controlled by the way we respond and perceive the environment, because that is what sets up the chemistry that controls our biology. And why that's so important is, if genes control you, you're a victim because you don't control genes in that story. But in the new science, and it's called epigenetics, it is now recognized that genes are controlled by our perceptions of the environment. And then all of a sudden it's like, but wait, you can change your perceptions of the environment. It's like, yes. And all of a sudden it's like, you mean you control your own biology by your beliefs and your attitudes and your emotions? And the answer is exactly. And by changing those beliefs, attitudes, and emotions, you can change your biology. And unfortunately, many people change their biology with the way we're running our emotions and beliefs right now, from a biology of health to a biology of disease. And that's because we are sending wrong kinds of signals and information from our beliefs about life into our body, and our body is suffering the consequences.
Well, having said that, Rufus, I have a question, and actually came out of the chat room, which I think is a really good question. So if our beliefs and our attitudes and, you know, our belief systems really are the contributing factor that we are, you know, that's the type of chemist that we are.
Yes.
And when we have those fatal belief systems that actually cause these cells to be degenerative rather than regenerative in their reproduction, the question is why would the body poison itself? I mean, what I mean by that, because I just want to extend on that, is if we start having those degenerative cells reproduce degeneratively, what does the body do to protect itself? I mean, are we battling ourselves?
Yeah. I'm going to make a statement. It's going to be almost simple, and it sounds very simple, but the meaning is so vastly deep that I want you to listen to it for a second, okay? And then pause just for a second. And here's the statement. The function of the mind is to create coherence between the beliefs and the reality that we experience. So the function of the mind is to look at the program of beliefs and adjust the biology so our life experiences match those beliefs. The cells, which I realized in my research back in this was 1985, is that there was one pivotal night in my that just transformed my entire life. This is a very important fact about cells. This is a truth. Cells are the biological equivalents of programmable chips. The nucleus of the cell is the equivalent of a hard drive. It's got gene programs. That's what genes are. They're programs in there, okay? But what is different is that while we used to teach, and unfortunately the public still believes, that this is a read-only disc, meaning, hey, those are the gene programs you got, and that's your life. That's the belief system we've been telling people, right? It turns out we now know, and this is, again, the science of epigenetics, that it's called a read-write disc, meaning that the genes can be selected and rewritten. Whatever genes you came with, you can rewrite the output of the genes. This is a number that it's so mind-boggling. You have to see this, because a gene is like a blueprint to make a protein, a molecule in the body, and the proteins are the building blocks. So the genes are blueprints to make the protein building blocks of the body. Here's what's interesting. We now recognize that through your mind and your perception, you can modify a single gene blueprint so as to create over 30,000 variations of products from the same blueprint. And all of a sudden it says, oh my God, there's no limitation on your ability to manipulate the readout of your genes. And the only limitations on it are actually your perceptions. And if you have a perception that you want to kill yourself, and a lot of people have this, it's not a conscious perception by any means, It is an unconscious response to developmental experiences generally. The issues are, if that's what the system's program is, what's the function of the mind? Function of the mind is to make coherence between the program and the reality. And so, for example, if you have a distortion in your program, then you will distort your physical reality. I'll give you an example. Let's say we're talking to an anorexic, and we see this anorexic, and their skin and bones are near death, and we're just like, oh, this person is near death. And we say, well, we see you this way, but when you look in the mirror, what do you see? Well, they say, when I look in the mirror, I see a bloated person staring back at me. You know, that's like a distortion, like a funhouse mirror distortion.
Right.
Why is this relevant? Because the distortion is what the mind perceives. And it doesn't perceive it as a distortion. That's what it sees, period. So it has a misperception. But the issue is, then in response to the misperception, the brain chemistry will send signals to the body to reduce that bloated person so that they get back down to weight. Well, the fact is, the cells are already at their end at this point, but the cells respond to the chemistry. They don't. The cells, well, sentient beings, in the nature of their body, when the cells are in your body, they're part of a community. And here's the nature of a real community. When you join a community, you join because you agree to the common goal or whatever the community is about to do. If you're in a community and you say, well, I'm going to do whatever the heck I want, you're not a member of the community. Community follows the common goal. So the cells are in a community. And if the boss of the community, which is the mind and which is controlling everything, says, you need to die, the cells are programmable, as I'm saying, programmable chips, and the signals sent from the brain are like fingers that type on the surface of the keys and call up the programs. So if you have, you know, thoughts that compromise your life or thoughts of fear, whatever these things are, you will adjust the chemistry. The chemistry moves through the body. It's like typing fingers. Different chemicals type different information into the cells. The cells are these programmable chips, and they will conform to whatever the program said. And why that's important is that it's about as simple and fundamental understanding as I can tell you right now. The cells are programmable chips. The programming agent is the chemistry that runs through the blood as well as the electromagnetic fields that are set up by the mind. And that these signals from the electromagnetic fields and signals from the chemistry are used by the cell to adjust their behavior and their genetics. So basically, it says we are creating our biology minute by minute and day by day with our attitudes and our beliefs and emotions, and that when we change those beliefs and attitudes and emotions, there'll be almost an instantaneous change of the body to accommodate that.
Well, but you know, Bruce, I just have to ask you, we have questions percolating in the chat room here, and I'm trying to keep up with them as they're scrolling up, but here's a really interesting question, because you spoke about the skin being our, you know, our own petri dish. Now,
It's like enclosing our petri dish. It's a skin-covered petri dish, yes.
Okay, so this question's going to now take us outside of our skin and the world around us. And what I still want to focus on the body, though.
It's the same thing. Go ahead. Same story. Yeah. So let's go, because I think we can answer the question, and it'll reflect both the influence of the environment on the cell and the influence on the environment on the human. Okay?
Okay. Means that we're made up of some 90% water.
Yeah.
One of the questions was, do you acknowledge Masaru Emoto's work and having that water has this consciousness, and it's really related to our perception of its environment that causes the change in water.
Okay, first technical question.
Yep,
first technical question is this. Water carries information. This is a fact. This is the basis of homeopathy. That's why you can put a chemical into a water. It fuses the water with information about the chemical, but if you dilute it, the water and dilute it and dilute the water, the information stays in, but the chemistry gets diluted out, so that in a true homeopathic, you don't have any of the original chemical in there at all. You're just carrying the information that's in the water. So That is the basis of homeopathy, and essentially it's a similar same thing that Emoto was talking about in regard to influencing the field of a water. Yes, we do influence the field. We influence the field so greatly that to limit it to the water is actually a disservice to our own powers. For this reason, this is a given fact of physics, so I stand here as like, it's a fact of physics whether we as a collective group respond to it or not. It's still a fact of physics, and that is the observer creates the reality. And we are creating this reality, and this is a rule of physics, and that's where it stems from. You can never avoid this issue. And yet we have successfully not talked about it because physicists themselves had trouble with this nature, this characteristic of quantum physics in 1925 when it was first introduced, because they said, wait a minute, I could see how the observer might determine whether that's a particle, a wave, whatever's making up the atom, but what do you mean the observer in my life is creating what's unfolding in my life? Physicists said, okay, look, here's what we're going to do. Arbitrarily, we're going to keep that notion of the observer affecting reality at the level of atoms. And it's very convenient to talk about it at the level of atoms, and we won't really bring it into the human world because people couldn't do it. And it's interesting because the physicists of today, right now, are saying, look, it was in 1925 when they arbitrarily said that, and it was totally incorrect. Quantum physics principles apply at every level, whether I'm focusing on experiments with atoms or I'm working with people in a community. It basically says that our creative processes that are in our mind are influential in shaping the world that we experience in our life. And that's why I also said, the function of the mind is to take the programs, not just the biological interior programs, but our programs about how we relate to external life, and turn those programs into reality. And that is pure quantum physics, pure biology, psychology, and whatever else you want to say. And then comes the biggest problem that I think people will have in this. I guess let me terminate the question because this is a bigger thing at some point, is that, yes, by creating the field of intention,
yes,
we can put information into matter. And then you say, you mean the invisible field is influencing the physical matter? And then I go back to a fundamental understanding provided by Einstein. And it's like, again, I just love it because it's the short little fundamental ones that are the blowaway statements because they're just this big. And here's the statement. Einstein's nature on the relevance of quantum physics and energy and matter, this was a statement. The field is the sole governing agency of the particle. What he meant by that is the field, and we use the word field as the invisible forces, okay?
Right.
And interesting enough, spiritual people would define the same thing as spirit. So field and spirit are essentially the same terms. But in physics, it's the invisible forces. And so it says the field, the invisible forces, are the sole governing agency of the particle, the matter, the material world. So it basically is the premise of physics. Yeah, the field, thoughts and belief and consciousness are primary shapers of the physical mechanical world that we live in. That are you could say instead of the field, I could say the mind, which is a field. The mind is the sole governing agency, not of the particle in this case, but of the body. And again, that is a truism as well. And so it becomes very difficult for people to recognize that your thoughts and your beliefs and attitudes are actually creating things in front of us. You want to change the message in water? You can change that with your belief and your intention. You want to change the message in your genes? You can change that with your belief and intentions. Then people will say, okay, now we're going really woo-woo here, Lipson, because now what you're trying to tell me is I'm creating this life, and then a person would look at me and say, you think I would have created this for myself? I'm not creating. I wouldn't have brought this into my life. And now I'm going to have to say, here's the secret. And if you get the secret, then you're on the first biggest major step of the evolution that's in front of us right now. And the secret is knowing how it works. And the secret is the nature of how does that mind control, you know, how does it control the behavior in biology? Okay, and I said, well, the mind is a perception that it's the brain in function. It's sort of like the brain is like a radio and the mind is like a show. you can't. The show that comes out of the radio is not physical. It's information, but it's not physical. And the radio is physical. The brain's physical. And the mind is not. And here's the nature of it. The mind is involved with creation and habits, and its function is to control the rest of the system. And now here comes the issue. And this is the crux of almost everyone's misunderstanding of how come I read all the books and it doesn't work. And it goes like this. There are two minds that work as co-conspirators in a sense of controlling our biology. The bigger mind is called the subconscious mind. It is a large, massive part of the brain. The smaller mind is called the conscious mind, and it's related to an add-on addition at the front of the brain that evolved over evolution. And the subconscious mind is like a million times more powerful a processor than the prefrontal part of the brain called the conscious mind.
Mm-hmm.
Now, here's the difference. The conscious mind is the one connected to your personal identity, your spirit, your source, whatever you want to say is your connection in some way. That personal mind is you. The conscious mind. Now, here's the character of it. It's creative. And why is that relevant? Because it's the one that can create all the things you want in your life. So now here comes the issue. I say, Susie, what do you want from your life? And whatever answer you give me, it will come from the creative conscious mind. That's the one that has your wishes, your desires, your aspirations. I say, whatever you want in your life, the seed of that is the conscious mind. It has your wishes and desires in that. And then I say, okay, and the subconscious mind has habits. There's nobody in it. It's a device that learns from its previous experiences, and through those previous experiences, download programs of behavior. There's no entity in there. It's an automatic device. It's like a like an automatic pilot. Once you learn a habit, you don't have to concentrate on it. It will automatically play from the subconscious mind. And the subconscious mind has programs, okay? Now, here's the catch. And if people get to this is where we come onto the catch. You ready? We have a belief that we run our lives with our desires and wishes from our conscious mind. Yes, I want to have health. I want to have wonderful relationships. I want to make money and live in comfort. Those are your conscious mind's desires for sure. But now what we found out is neuroscientists have revealed that only at the most about 5% of our life is controlled by the conscious mind. Less than 5%, most people, about 1% of your life is controlled by your conscious mind, meaning the conscious mind has this unique ability of this creative character of thinking that allows it to think into the future, think into the past, solve problems, work out issues. That's what the conscious mind does. But then the point is, when the conscious mind is doing those things, And think about this, thoughts are flipping through your mind every second, and these thoughts take your conscious mind. But if the conscious mind is engaged in these thinking processes, then who's running the show? And the answer is, that's when the subconscious runs the show. And the reason is because the conscious mind is off thinking and creating and doing whatever it is, and therefore the programs from running the show are now coming from the subconscious habit mind. Now, just so people understand the relationship, you don't come with habits essentially built in. Instincts are built in, but habits you acquire. I'll give an example. Before you got your driver's permit, you didn't know how to drive a car. You got a driver's permit, you didn't know just because you got the permit how to drive the car. You had to get in the car, and you had to put your hands on the wheel and your feet on the pedals, and you had to watch the mirrors and look out the window.
Confidence, right?
Very conscious. In fact, some people actually freeze in the seat because it takes so much conscious effort to control everything that some people freeze behind the wheel. Okay, now I'm going to say, so that was your first bit of driving, but now you've been driving all these years, right? And now I say, look, Susie, you and I get in the car. We're carrying out this discussion. We're having a great time. You're driving the car, and we get so involved with this discussion that at some point you look out the window and it dawns on you, you actually haven't paid attention to the road for the last 10 minutes. And then I'm going to say, well, then who was driving the car? And the answer was, the subconscious mind, because once you learn how to drive a car, you don't have to watch it anymore. You get in the car, you put the keys in the ignition, you're thinking about the store or the destination. You're not even thinking about all the mechanical aspects of driving the car. It's automatic. But here comes the issue. You and I were having that discussion. Our conscious minds were engaged, and the subconscious was driving the car. Now listen to this. Your conscious mind can recall the conversation. You can tell me all the things we just talked about. But if I ask your conscious mind, say, wait, tell me about the conditions on the road and all the driving experience during that 10 minutes while we were having the conversation. And you would say, I don't know, I didn't see it. I was talking to you. And now this is profound. And, mm-hmm. Now this is so profound. Please just, I hope the listeners are just listening to this.
Oh, they're flipping out in the chat room. So
well, let me tell you why it's profound. Because you did not observe the behavior of the subconscious mind, because when the conscious mind's engaged and the subconscious mind is therefore called in to do behavior, from driving the car to doing the job that you work at or to talking to somebody even, the subconscious mind will just run the program without you actually paying attention. What it means is you didn't see that behavior. So that is the first thing I have to bring up. 95%
of
our, yeah.
So in effect, with that conscious competence is not coming from the conscious mind, it's coming from the subconscious mind.
Right, and unobserved. Because if I ask you to say, listen, describe the driving, you just did it with your subconscious mind. You say, no, my conscious mind was busy. That's why the subconscious mind did it, but then I didn't see it. That means that the behaviors that are operating up to 95 to 99% of the day from the subconscious mind, when they're engaged, we rarely even see them. And we don't even actually, it's just so automatic behavior that it, we don't even think about it. It's just automatic behavior. You drove the car, you got home, you didn't think of all the details. You were thinking about getting home. So why is this relevant? Oh, man, this is it. You ready? I tell the story in the lecture, and most people are very familiar with it. And it's a funny story, and it's the ultimate profound story. And it goes like this. You know somebody, a friend. And you know your friend's parent. And at some point, you begin to see that your friend shares the same behavioral characters as their parent. So on one day, you just casually let out, you know, Bill, you're just like your dad. And you back away
yeah.
from Bill because he's going to vent, right? And he's going to say, what are you talking about? Now, it's funny and profound. Here's the meaning. Everyone else can see that Bill is like his dad because Bill is playing the programs he downloaded from his father in the subconscious mind automatically. It's Bill who doesn't see it. He's the only one that didn't see it. But why is that relevant? Because he does not observe the unconscious behavior, because it's called unconscious behavior. And why is that relevant? Now we put all the last pieces together and it goes like this. Your conscious mind has your wishes and your desires and what you want from life. And then I go, what about the programs in the subconscious mind? And this is the blow-away fact. The primary fundamental programs that drive your subconscious programming were derived from other people. They're not from you. You got them from your parents, your family, your community, your schooling when you were very young.
Mm-hmm.
And they were downloaded into your mind in the first 5 years of your life. And why I'm also saying they were downloaded is for this reason. When we look at the brain activity of a child, the EEG, we put the wires on the brain, read the activity. Listen to this. A child does not express conscious behavior from the brain as a predominant brain state until after 6 years of age.
Yes, yes.
What that means is, for the first 5 years of a child's life, its EEG brain activity is a little lower than conscious alpha activity, theta. Theta activity is the hypnagogic trance. It says that a child, for its first years of its life, is in a hypnotic trance, downloading all the rules, regulation, languages, social things, culture, everything, from the environment like a sponge. It's just downloading it. And you say, why? And then I go like this. I say, hey, Susie, if we were doing Oprah, if you were Oprah, you could say, listen, everybody, look under your chair. There's a new iPod. And then everybody pulls out this new iPod, and they get all excited, and I say, here, open up your iPod box. Pull out this new iPod and push play. And then you say, yeah, but nothing plays. And you go, yeah, but that's because there's no programs in it. Oh, you got to put programs before you can push play. Play is the equivalent of consciousness. If you could ask a child the moment it was born, you say, well, tell me something. That child, if it could say, it would say, I don't know what to say. I just got here. I don't know anything. So there wouldn't be any conversation. So consciousness is not very functional until the programs are put in. And so nature designed the brain to download the environmental signals and cues and observations and store them as programs into the subconscious mind before you're 6 years of age. And those are the programs that, unless they're changed, the very programs that went in first will follow you all the way to the grave and still be there at the end unless you change them. And why this is relevant is you run your life about 5% at the most with what you want, and then you run it 95% of the time invisibly with programs you got from other people.
And that takes up the most part of our brain capacity.
Absolutely.
So you can understand why there's so much garbage in that container is because the container's so big.
Absolutely. You know, and this is not a new thing because the Jesuits, they would advertise this. They would boast. They would go out and tell people, mm-hmm. you give me a child until it's 6 or 7, it will belong to the church for the rest of its life.
That's true, yes.
What they knew, what did they know? Whatever rules they put in the first 5 or 6 years will be the fundamental rules that will be there to the end of the life of that child unless that child changes the rules.
Well, I think there's some other entities out there that also have that knowledge.
Well, yeah, there absolutely are, but it was interesting because they had that knowledge and boasted it, and people never really caught on to what they were actually saying, is that they were programming an individual. And now we know here's the problem. All of us have been programmed. All of us are operating from fundamental programs that we acquired, especially from the last half of fetal development through the first 5 years of your life. Whatever you experienced was directly downloaded in your subconscious mind. Now listen to this. Without being filtered by consciousness, because you weren't engaging in consciousness. So whatever got downloaded was downloaded as an absolute truth because it was never put up for judgment. It was just downloaded. Now you say, wait a minute. Oh, now I could see this image as I walk through Kmart, and there's a family with a kid in a carriage in there, and the kid is just screaming bloody murder because he wants this toy, and in a fit of anxiety and emotion, the father yells out at this kid, you don't deserve that. Well, in that state of emotion, in that particular experiential setting, That almost is an instantaneous download in the subconscious mind. And now what is the download? The child download a fact, which was never contested by consciousness because it wasn't there, just a fact. I do not deserve. Now this child grows up and they're 40 years old. And they're working in some back room in some big plant. And in their conscious mind, the creative one with desires and wishes and aspirations, they're sitting there thinking, man, I'm better than this dead-end job. I should be running this whole division. What am I doing in this dead-end job? Oh, and the conscious mind is doing what? Thinking about what? About this issue. And when the conscious mind is thinking, who's running the show? The subconscious mind. Oh, yeah? What's the program in the subconscious mind? You do not deserve. And so the mind then creates a coherence. It creates a behavior that will elicit the reality of, guess what, you do not deserve. You look what you did. You screwed up when you weren't paying attention. And then, you know, you think about this. Most of us have taken exams in school. Go back to some kid's stage there. And you got your exam paper back. And many times you found questions marked wrong that you did wrong. You answered it incorrectly. But when you read the question, you said, I knew the answer to that question. And then you think, why the hell did I mark it that way? And all of a sudden, here's the point. Many of us were also programmed to be just average. You're just an average kid. Well, mm-hmm. How do I make average become reality? And the answer is, if I answer all the questions right, I'm not average. So the subconscious mind will actually take questions that you know the answer to and mark the wrong one when because it's, you know, it's operating unconsciously as you're doing this. Why? Because it calculated how many of them you should get right and wrong to become what? Average.
Well, how many of us now want to go back to our college or even elementary school records and change all of that?
Well, the fun part is this. When you know the truth of the mechanism, when you understand that most of the behaviors that we live by are invisible behaviors, most of them acquired from other people, and definitely a fact, most of them disempowering and limiting, these behaviors are the ones that shape our lives. And the issue, you know, a lot of people think, oh, God, what are those programs that are screwing with my life? Should I go back and find out what my teacher said, my dad did this, and my mom did this? And the fact is, no, don't even go there. And the reason is this. Those are the messengers that created a message. The message is the program. You don't have to go back and beat up any messengers over the program. You have to understand the program. Now, you don't have to find out who did what. The hell with them. Let's just get to the program. And now here's the fun part. Do you have to go backwards to go into your mind to see the program? The answer is nope, because here's another truth. The subconscious mind lives in the present moment. Even if it acquired a program when you were 5 years old, that program is programmed as a present time event. So when you were told when you were 5 years old by your father, you don't deserve that. At that moment of recording, I do not deserve that. It didn't say, in the future, I do not deserve that, or I only do not deserve this right now. It didn't. There's no time there. It just said, I do not deserve. That is a recording. You got it when you're 5 years old. I say, go in your subconscious, push this button, and you push this button, and guess what? The tape is going to play. You do not deserve this.
Yeah, well, that's where these recordings in our the neuroelectrons and are actually hardwired in these recordings. The more we vamp over them and enter situations where they come up. And each time they do that, isn't it true that we just reinforce them even
Absolutely.
More?
Absolutely. You're reliving the experiences. It's called a habituation, an exercise. The more you repeat something, the easier it is to get there. And so basically, you don't need to do this. And here's what you want to know what the programs are in your life. This is the fun part. Your life is a printout of your programs. So all you have to do is look around and say, hey, the things that you got, the things that you like, the things that give you satisfaction – you got programs in there that allow you to encourage you to do that. The things you're struggling over, almost inevitably, those things that you're struggling over are a reflection of programs that you have in your unconscious mind that are limiting you from acquiring that goal or that end. So the fun part is, geez, you don't have to go back and find out who did what to who. You just have to say, I have a problem with this, period, and just recognize. So then you've got a program that is encouraging that negative trait or whatever it is. And by understanding that, then you can, with like a surgeon, go into that subconscious mind and rewrite those programs. And this becomes very important. But here's the problem. Here's the problem that I had. So let me tell you, because I realized it myself at some point, and it was like, oh, my God, I was doing it wrong. And that is this. Conventional before Bruce awareness, okay? That's a BBA or something, before Bruce awareness. I'd have like these two personalities in myself. The one that was a perfectionist that somehow or other in my childhood, you had to do it, it had to be perfection, you know. And then there was this other personality I always considered, it was like Dopey in the Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs, you know. He was a nice guy, everybody loved him, but he always screwed up, you know. So and I recognized this, and at some point I'd screw up, and then I'd Dr. Beyond, I'd call the perfectionist, would yell at Dopey, what the hell is wrong with you? No, why can't you do this right? And I find out that I'd be upset with myself over these things. Or if I wanted to say, let's say, you know, hey, you're just eating so much junk food. Well, you know, let's get yourself a good talking to. So I tell myself a good thing. Okay, we're going to start right up now. And we're not going to go eat that junk food, right? So we have a good talking to myself. And then 10 minutes later, find myself with a donut in my hand. And then the next thing is, you stupid idiot. You can't even do that. And I realized at some point, oh, my God, that was inappropriate. And I learned it by accident because basically, one day I heard myself going through berating myself. And what I just stopped, like a third party, listening to one personality, myself talking to the other person, yelling at the other personality, and I just stopped and I thought, you know, why didn't you just acknowledge that you just caught yourself with a donut rather than yelling about the fact you had the donut in your hand? The other way of looking at it is you found yourself with a donut in your hand. That meant
right. Your
mind said, hey, you got a donut in your hand, instead of your mind looking around and saying, oh, you idiot. It should have said, oh, yeah, because that was the moment where the mind was saying, you want to put this donut down? And that's all it was saying, and yet my anger at myself overlooked that. And then I started to recognize, oh, that was, rather than yelling at yourself when you catch yourself, you actually congratulate yourself. I caught myself. Why? And this is fun. Because the subconscious habitual mind actually operates like a precocious 5-year-old.
Mm-hmm.
And why is that relevant? Because if you yell at a 5-year-old and be angry with it, you'd never encourage it to actually do any better. A 5-year-old actually gets more, you know, it gets worse, whatever the case is, than if you be nice and talk to yourself. And I started to recognize that instead of being upset with myself, when I would find myself in that position, the first thing I would say, oh, I caught myself. Isn't that great? And what I found out, the learning curve accelerated precipitously because I would catch myself earlier and earlier to the extent that it retrained itself under the approval and congratulations of catching itself, where it was resistant when I would be angry with myself.
Right, so it feels better to us to acknowledge that. And as soon as you finish with that, I do have a question, though, that kind of advances this a little bit. I'm intrigued.
Okay, so basically it just says, most of us do not like the behaviors when we catch the unconscious behaviors. Then we give ourselves a good talking to, which is not really that good, probably angry talking to at that
point.
And what my point about this whole thing is when you are talking to yourself, who are you talking to? And then all of a sudden it's like, well, I'm talking to myself. Well, you're trying to talk to your subconscious, right? That's the one that ran the program. And then here's the funny part. There's nobody in the subconscious. It's a machine like a tape player. It records from habit and plays back at the push of a button. And why is that relevant? Well, if in the old days when we had like tape recorders, and let's say there was a tape playing in your tape recorder and there was a music or a story or whatever it is, and you didn't like the program, and then you go up and you talk to the tape player, you know, hey, tape player, you know, I don't like that program. Do you have another program you can play besides that? Maybe one that I would like and all that? And my point is, how much talking to the tape player will it take before the tape changes? And the answer is, obviously, that's not the way that the tape player works. You just wasted all that time because it's a tape player. It learns from habituation. And that's what I was saying just before we're talking about it. If I tried to habituate it with anger, the precocious 5-year-old quality to the subconscious mind actually rebels against that and prefers to be loved like a child would be loved and learns faster that way. So rather than giving ourselves a good talking to about the negative, we should start giving ourselves pats on the back and congratulations as I caught myself, because at that moment of catching yourself and whatever it was, that was a moment of choice where you could say, okay, put that thing down. And then
okay,
you have control.
So now I want to get back to the donut, and I just want to push that envelope a little bit more. But first, we do have a caller on the line, and I was wondering if possibly you...
Sure.
Oh, great. Hold on one sec. Let me bring them on here. Hello, 704. What's your name and what's your question?
This is Jennifer. Hi, Susie. Hi, Dr. Lipton.
Hi, Jennifer. Bruce here.
Great. Hello, Bruce. Well, I have a question because I recently begun working with a children's home that helps with severely abused children.
Yes.
And I'm currently working with the staff, and I'm a certified Lifeline practitioner with Dr. Weissman's work. And working with him or working with the staff, I want to give them additional ways to work with these children that are going to help them with some of the programming that's already done at a very young age.
Absolutely.
With
abuse. Absolutely.
Can you help with some of your
top
favorites?
Yes, I'm
going to
first let me give you an organization's name and a website. Firstly, because I was on the board of this organization, and it's a great resource for information. Okay, the organization is called. I'll give you the letters A P APPPAH. APA. A three P's AH. And it's an Association for Prenatal and Perinatal Psychology and Health.
Okay.
Website is birthpsychology.com. This whole organization is predicated on understanding and dealing with the issues of programming that occurs starting in fetal development. So even when a child is born, it is already half of its personality is already developed. And this becomes very important because conventional people have not recognized a truism, and that is when I was teaching in medical school, we would teach about the role of the mother. She's the nourisher of the developing fetus. That the control of the fetus was by its own genes, so that the mother's only role was just to provide nourishment, then let the fetus genetically unfold into the pre-program that we thought was unfolding. We now have a profoundly, totally different awareness. We now recognize that genes do not control this process. It's the response of the cells to the environment that control this. And here's why this is relevant. The fetal cells, yes, they get nutrition from the mother because the mother's blood crosses the placenta and nourishes the fetus. But what we left out of the equation was nutrition is not the only thing in blood. In blood are all the emotional chemicals, all the growth factors, all the hormones, all the immune regulatory agents. And why is that relevant? Because whatever the mother is experiencing emotionally, psychologically, physically, those information molecules that she's experiencing are also crossing the placenta and affecting the fetus. And so now we know that when patterns of behavior repeat themselves, the fetus is learning the patterns through the waves of chemistry that are going through the system. And that when a mother is happy, the emotional chemistry of happiness is affecting the fetus. When the mother is nervous or scared, the fetus is scared. If the parents reject the child is bathed in the chemistry of emotional rejection. And the significance about all this is we were programmed even before we were born. And since we don't know this, there starts to be a lot of issues, especially when kids are adopted, because a lot of people think, oh, I just got this baby, clean slate. And it's like, if you just adopted a baby, there's going to be some trauma in there somewhere because you're adopting a baby, that something went wrong in that, and the baby has already been programmed. And this applies to the kids through that five-year period. They get programmed. That's why there's a truism also that when a child's parents die by the age of five, that child will grow up and still have the same behavioral characteristics of their parent because by five it's downloaded. And so then working with children that have been through all this stuff, they have been programmed profoundly. And when they become abused, here's what the tendency is. When anyone is attacked at any level, an adult, a child, or whatever it is, the biological response is called protection. And protection means you wall yourself off from the outside world. And the significance of all this abuse that goes on with children, whether it's emotional or physical abuse or nutritional abuse, these end up causing a child to separate itself from the nature of community. It becomes very difficult and must be understood by the caretakers and caregivers that these programs could stem all the way back to fetal development stages, and that we have to recognize the nature of a child responding from its subconscious programming, and that talking to the conscious mind does not change the subconscious programming. So that's why, hey, I read this great self-help book. I got it. I understand it. Hey, my life is exactly the same. And the reason is this. Yeah, your conscious mind learned from that experience, but your subconscious mind is a habituation mind. It learns from experiential habituation. So reading a book all of a sudden makes you consciously aware and has no influence on the subconscious program just by that means alone. I think I traveled on and on your question, which I thought was very important, and I started rattling. I'm very sorry, but why it's relevant is it's time for us to go beyond conventional understanding and start to recognize the nature of this programming stuff that occurs so early and then is so controlling for the rest of our lives, and that the dialogue, there is no open dialogue window by trying to talk to their conscious mind, thinking that just because you gave them a nice talk that all of a sudden the subconscious mind is going to change. That's not absolutely really a likely event at all. It basically said, no, that's not how the subconscious mind learns. So there's a lot that the Centers for Care and Helping could really start to acquire in regard to the new information coming into biology, because it is so significantly different than the genetic-based biochemical conceptions that we hold in conventional medicine.
Wow.
I went on, but I thought there was something in there that might be important somewhere.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you for your question, Jennifer. It was really important. And
I hope I got that, Jennifer. Excuse me if I didn't.
I guess I was looking for, like, if there's any, like, with abuse with children, if there's one thing you could say you could do to tap into that subconscious mind place that they're, you know, protecting themselves, you know, from the environment. Is there anything that you'd say that would be, you know, to give to the staff, to give to the children, to say, okay, that's one of the, you know, that's part of the magic that's going to work to help heal and harmonize?
The basic thing is a total distrust of the external environment, and so it's the things that garner trust that are the most important, and the sincerity. And the fact is, they know when people are talking at them, and they know when people are with them, and that's a very different approach. Because when we look down and talk to them as healer to patient, teacher to student, that has already been problematical in the first place, because they were already students to whatever teachers created the problem in the first place. They need to be really met on a completely different level, on a human-to-human, person-to-person contact level.
Okay.
And if you look on my website, brucelipton.com, there's a whole section called Resources. And there's a whole thing about conscious parenting, which is very critical, and those are the resources of information of how to be conscious parents or how to be conscious healers with kids, whether you're the parent or the healer. In this case, it'd still be exactly the same. So please look under Resources on brucelipton.com, and there'll be some good places to go. Thank you, Jennifer.
Thank you.
Thank you, Jennifer. Enjoy your journey.
Absolutely.
Okay. Bruce, while we got you to mention your website, let's just take a little moment here to associate with what it is that on our show page that people can connect with, because we've placed it all over the show page. We have both your books, including the one you can pre-order now, which is Spontaneous Evolution, which I'm really excited about, that's coming out, and I can't wait.
Me too.
Yeah, so I just want to let everyone know you can go to the show page if you're on there already and click on Bruce's dynamically smiling face, and that will take you right to his website, which is www.brucelipton.com, as well as the books, The Biology of Belief, and you can also pre-order from Amazon or Barnes & Noble, but there is a link there that will take you to pre-order the new book, Spontaneous Evolution, which you co-authored.
With a friend of mine, Swami Beyondananda is his comic stage name. He's a satirist. Maybe you've seen him. Some people have. Swami Beyondananda. His name is Steve Behrman. And we collaborated on this, and it was very wonderful, because the new book also, it's so very critical about what's going on in our world today, and the humor that is in it that he helped facilitate as well. As well as the points of saying things in this uplifting way is very helpful, because so many people are so threatened by what's going on in the world today, and what this book is about is we are exactly where we're supposed to be in our evolution, because this is an evolutionary event of massive proportions that is happening right now, and what we're looking at in regard to, like, crises and fuel crises, environmental or global warming crises, economic crises, healthcare crises, and you think, wow, look, there are crises springing up all over the place. And the interesting thing is, a lot of people look at this as individual events and separate entities, and the reality is, no, it's all one big event that's occurring, and that is we're going through an upheaval of civilization and rewriting the structure of our civilization, and for very good reason. And that reason is, if we continue doing what we've been doing, the writing is on the wall, we're going extinct. And so there's a simple reality. Either continue what you're doing, continue the world and just go on, say, it'll fix itself somehow. That's the path to extinction. But the reality is that's not our path. We're in a process of evolving to a higher level, a different organization. And to do that, you actually have to restructure the institutions and foundations of the civilization, because the current institutions and corporations and foundations are structures that are keeping us in this pathway to hell, actually, and they're unfolding, they're coming undone, because they are not sustainable. We will not survive unless we change the foundation. So when you look around and it gets very scary out there, and rightfully so, there's something else we should start to recognize, that rather than focusing on the scary disassembly, we are really more hopefully going to focus on the new assembly of what's coming up. It's very interesting. I mentioned before that cells are like miniature people. And then I would tell you this, that inside a caterpillar, there are millions and millions of cells, again, like miniature people. So there's a community of these like miniature people, millions of them, inside a growing caterpillar. While the caterpillar is growing, all the cells are doing jobs, digestion system, musculoskeletal system, whatever, you know, working and keeping this whole living thing alive. So every cell is doing a job and contributing. And you would say, wow, the economy is booming in this growing caterpillar. And then one day, the growth starts to slow down. You know, the economy starts changing. The businesses don't have so much business anymore. Cells are being laid off. There's not so much digestion going on. All of a sudden, the systems start falling apart. If you were a cell in the middle of that, you know, community that is falling apart, you'd be looking like we are today at our world going, oh my God, this thing is falling apart. You know, we're going to die. And the fact is a lot of cells actually commit suicide, a biological process called apoptosis. And it's actually a pathway. It's almost like taking a pill and going, I'm out of here. And yet, here's what's neat. In the middle of all this decay and destruction and the system falling apart, there are other cells that are genetically identical to all the other cells, but they're called imaginal cells. And the imaginal cells, though genetically identical, perceive the world in a different way. Mm-hmm. And what happens is this group of imaginal cells gets larger and larger and larger, and pretty soon it's the imaginal cells that construct the new thing called the butterfly that is the evolutionary advance that leaves the body of the old caterpillar and flies off into a higher level of evolution.
Well, and the butterfly effect.
Yeah, and we're in that right now. And the listeners on this show, if they're listening to this show, are sure as heck the imaginal cells that are looking and seeking another story, another future, another evolution than sticking with the structure that is now in a state of decay. And so my point about this is, yeah, you can see the decay around you, but better to focus on the beautiful thing, the new humanity, the new civilization that will come from this.
Well, you know, we were very fortunate to have Barbara Marks Hubbard join us a couple of weeks ago, and she really opened the doors to let us know how we can do that. And I'd like to just steer, I think we have about 15, 16 minutes left in the show, but if we can now take this and looking at just really how, what a crucial part science plays in the current paradigm, because we're not talking woo-woo stuff here.
No.
We're talking about scientific breakthroughs now. And if there's one thing that stirs the human practical mind, it's science. So it's such a crucial step in this convergence of the subconscious mind, our beliefs, our attitudes, and spirit working through us and flowing through us and converging in these scientific discoveries, you know, in our push forward and building this momentum, because I feel the momentum and I see it and it's just increasing and increasing. And, you know, what about those folks that just don't get it? And I think that science just magnificently becomes that bridge for us. So what can we do, Bruce?
Well, I think the first thing is, look, in the old hippie days, there was a phrase that we will have to resurrect and bring it right back and dust it off and put it right up on the mantle, and that is, take care of your own backyard before taking care of the universe.
Mm-hmm.
And so what it really means is, and this is what's really written in my book as well, because I had to describe the fact that most of our behaviors are 95% or more driven from the programs that we got from others, and that most of those are the limiting factors that are preventing us from making the big evolutionary leap. So the first things that we really have to do is recognize, yes, we all want to evolve. We all want to create what we would like to have for a wonderful world. That is, again, what? The conscious mind. One, that's the creative mind. That's the one I said, tell me what you want. It's conscious mind. So I can say, yep, we're all on the same page, conscious mind. But we're surely not all on the same page, subconscious mind. And most of us are being self-sabotaged in our desires to see an evolution, to see the changes, because of the limiting programs that we acquired in our development. So the first step in the evolution is to identify those programs. And I said they're easy because they're the ones that are preventing you from making those steps forward that you've been trying to make all the time. And then start to recognize how you can reprogram and change them. And it's very difficult because, as I said, we've always heard, well, what about positive thinking? And then I love this because I say, well,
right.
Positive thinking, which mind does that come from? And the answer is, well, the conscious mind. I say, isn't that great? That one works about 1 to 5% of the time, and the other mind is a million times more powerful, is working 95% of the time, the subconscious one. So the point is, how successful can positive thinking be? And the answer is this. It is only successful if the subconscious mind already agrees with that positive thinking,
mm-hmm.
if it already has programs that agree with it. If the subconscious mind doesn't agree with that, then positive thinking is like yelling into the wind. It's like it's not going to make that change necessarily by itself. There are other things to do to enhance your ability to program yourself. When you program yourself and become empowered, that is the point where then you're it doesn't mean you get rid of the subconscious mind. It means you put only programs in there that give you the things you want in your life as compared to the programs you acquired from other people that don't give you those things. And why is this relevant? Because we're all individual creators. And if we were all given the option to actually create with our personal beliefs versus the ones we were programmed with, I can assure you this world would be profoundly different. Because I would trust the collective creation of the mass of population to the creation that is derived from the few leaders that are programming us with their beliefs. Because you can just take a survey anywhere in the world at any time of the average people, and you say, do you want to have a war? And they'll say no. Do you want to be healthy? Yes. Do you want to be happy? Absolutely yes. You find, hey, the whole entire damn population has the same vision. It's the leadership that,
mm-hmm.
and how did they control us? Because they're more powerful. And you say, wait. There are more powerful people and less powerful people? And this is the jokey part. If you understand the biology, we are all equally powerful creators of the world that we live in. And then you say, well, wait a minute. If we're all equally powerful, how did those people over there get more power? And this is the jokey part. They didn't get more power. They took away the power from the other people.
And we gave it.
And we gave it up, but we didn't know it. How did anybody? Nobody knew. So there's this ignorance thing. And this is the hard part of accepting responsibility. Because all of a sudden, if you really understand the nature of the biology, the truth is this. If you understand how this biology works, then you are personally responsible for everything in your life. The moment I used to end my lecture with that, people would be so angry they'd throw things at me. Because it was like, how can I take responsibility for these things that happen in my life? And they would be very upset. And I didn't know how to change the answer because basically the mechanism was that we are creating this. And then one day this one woman came in after a lecture, and she was so emotionally distraught about things that are in life, and she couldn't handle the concept of victim and blame and guilt and all that. And she came in and she said, I need a different answer. And I was like, well, a different answer? That's the answer. And then I paused for a second. I said, how about this? You are personally responsible for everything in your life once you become aware
mm-hmm.
that you are personally responsible for everything in your life. What does this mean? Very simple, top level right here. if you didn't understand the stuff I was just talking about up to this radio show, and your life was programmed by all these events and everything, that meant you were ignorant of how it worked, as we all have been, and you didn't know what was going on, so therefore I can't say there's any blame, guilt, or victim involved. Nobody knew what the hell they were doing. But once you become aware of this mechanism that brings in personal responsibility, because if you are aware of how it works, then it is your responsibility to run it to create the things you wanted to create and not the things that other people programmed. So let's get rid of blame and guilt and victim and who said what to who and who did what and who's ultimately responsible. It's irrelevant because most of the problems are actually derived from people from generations ago that have been propagated parent to child, without anybody knowing it. So it's wonderful because we start with a clean slate and say, I don't care what age you are at this moment, you get a clean slate. Why? Because you have an opportunity to review your programming system and rewrite the programs and create a life that's based on your wishes and desires when you know how it works and way it worked before and why you had so much difficulty in creating what you want. And this is, you know, as I said, most people have trouble realizing they've actually created this. And then at some point, if I could, in the last minute, let me give you a big up thing, a big up. And that is, yes, we are creating our lives. And I'm going to now suggest something. I'm going to suggest that almost every listener on this broadcasting thing right now had a period in their life where in their creative nature, they created personal heaven on earth, where they were so healthy, so energized. Life was so beautiful. And it was this period where I'm saying, this was not an accident or coincidence. This was a creation, a purposeful, intentional creation. And I'll say, you know when that was in your life? And then I'm going to say, think about this. Go back to the time in your life when you were so fully head over heels in love. You fell in love, man. You just met this other person, and it's like, oh, my God, the stars have come down on earth. I am so in love. That I say, go back to that period, which I call the honeymoon period, and I'm going to say, guess what? Go back and tell me. In that honeymoon period, were you healthy? And yeah, it was really healthy. It was excitable. Do you have energy? Man, I made love for days in a row. Didn't even sleep in there. And I say, how about things in life around you? It was beautiful. Every day I woke up, and I was just having this wonderful, loving relationship, and the sun shined, and I think, you know what? That wasn't a coincidence. That was a creation. A honeymoon is a creation, and the reason why is because it was the one time in your life you didn't rely on the habits and programs, but you were very self-conscious of yourself to make sure that you were living the life that you were had intended in your conscious mind. I give examples.
Okay, so,
yeah.
So, Ruza, and I don't mean to interrupt you. We have about 7 minutes, and we do have one call on here.
I need seven more hours. Okay, go ahead.
Yes, I know. We do, too. I should try to extend this show if I knew how to do this. Maybe people can help me in the chat room. But
well,
anyway, I want to bring on a caller, and I believe she was in the chat room asking about, because I think this is perfect, but if we can, you know, keep it brief until I can find out what's going on. But
let's go.
Let me just bring her on. Hold on. Hi, Sue. Are you on the air?
Yes, I am.
Okay. Hi. Welcome.
Thank you. Great to be here.
What's your question for Bruce?
Oh, sorry. Hi, Bruce. It's wonderful to hear you talk. I'm listening to all this stuff, and you know we've all heard about subconscious mind before, how it works. You're talking about it at a deeper level. We're hearing you say we need to reprogram our minds.
Yes.
But so, how really do we deal with reprogramming our minds, reprogramming our subconscious, getting rid of the old stuff? How specifically do we do that? For instance, how do we heal and deal with chronic conditions like cancer or pain or inflammation or migraines or stuff that just keeps coming back and it's been with us? What steps really do we take?
Okay, the first step is to recognize this. Rarely is there an organic cause for any of those issues. Almost all those issues stem from the fact that there are programs playing and the body is responding to you. Symptoms and emotions are the cell's way of communicating back to the nervous system their response to what's going on. Symptoms are, of course, very important because they point to a fact that something is wrong someplace. The unfortunate tendency of our health profession is that we have a tendency to cover up the symptoms, so if the symptom goes away, then everything is fixed. Well, this is a symptom is the equivalent of gauges on the dashboard of a car. When the light comes on that says service engine now, you don't get mad at the light and say, you shut off that light. The light was telling you about a problem. The symptoms that you have are the equivalent of the gauges in the lights. Our tendency is to just cover them up so you don't feel the symptoms, and now you think that I've resolved the issue. And the fact is, no, you didn't. You shut the population up, and they were trying to tell you to deal with an issue. So that means going back and understanding what conflicts in our programs in life are really precipitating a physical illness. And that's why I would go, like, for example, one reference I use quite frequently is Louise Hay's book, Heal Your Life, I think that's the name of it. In the back of it is a glossary of body parts and different kinds of disease entities. And what's interesting is you can identify very specific emotions that are related to driving different diseases in different parts of the body. She's not 100% correct, but she's darn close. And why? That's why it's worth it. And so the significance is this. Stop treating the symptoms. I mean, you can work with them, okay? But the idea is recognize the symptoms are telling you of something else. So by focusing on the physical, biochemical things, you're missing the point. It is trying to say there's a conflict in the way you're leading your life, and that conflict is precipitating a physical problem in a specific area of the body, usually. Again, it's sort of like the anorexic. You can say, oh, look how thin you are. It's not the thinness. It's the conflict actually has to do with the fact that there's a distortion in the perceptions. Well, that's what I'm saying almost all illnesses are. Yes, indeed, there are some organically caused illnesses, but they amount to probably less than 5% of all the illnesses on the planet. 95% of most of illnesses are really generally a reflection of our operating our biological mechanism and having perceptual problems that are causing conflicts. So that's where I start, okay? And the issue about that is also we have things called stem cells throughout our bodies, and our stem cells can repair anything, and everything in the body can be repaired and replaced by stem cells. But they will not do that if that's not part of the person's vision. And unfortunately, as I said in the programming that almost all of us got, one of the limitations that we acquired in belief is our inability to heal ourselves, that others do the healing. And therefore, we buy their beliefs and their opinions as our truth. And that's why so frequently the patients so wonderfully conform to the doctor's diagnosis, more so because once the diagnosis is made, that's the program, and then the body will then actually create that. So there are ways of doing that. How can you change the programs? My website, brucelipton.com, has a resource list of ways of changing it. There are several different ways. Several of them are really based on total habituation. Affirmations are good, but then most people don't treat them the way they must be treated. Affirmations work when they're habits because the subconscious mind works from habits. You write a little note on your mirror and you look at it occasionally. That's not a habit. A habit is something you reinforce, and as you put it in, it will rewrite the programming. Once you repeat something over and over again, you have an ability to consciously create habits. But it's an exercise that does that. There are some very much more accelerated ways of changing. One of them includes clinical hypnotherapy, which is the mechanism by which you got the original programs in the first place. That's the five-year-old up from fetal to five-year-old of development. You are in a hypnotic trance. So going back into that is like state-dependent learning. You go right back into the same state you learned in the first place. You can rewrite the programs. There's a variety of new healing modalities that really work on energy fields more than on the physical body, collectively called energy psychology. And some of them are so profound that changes can occur within 10 minutes. And this is so exciting because we're really running into a time crunch because evolution is upon us and we really must accelerate the process. And so energy psychology modalities come in as one of the new very rapid resources of reprogramming the subconscious mind. Another way of doing it is living in what is called Buddhist mindfulness. Now, it's a very difficult process because the world is so busy, but what it basically says, Buddhist mindfulness was the stage you were in when you were in your honeymoon stage, meaning you weren't letting the tapes run. You were looking in the mirror. You were self-reflective. You were running it with your conscious mind, and that's it takes effort, and that's why most people just don't even go there. They just do the 95% from the habit. But why it's relevant is if you live in your conscious mind, that is a way of generating new habits that are based on your wishes and desires. And this becomes important because if you put in a program into your subconscious mind that is destructive, then you get a dis-ease from it. But you can just as easily put in a program that's constructive, meaning you could unconsciously just move through the day and unconsciously your program would lead you to success or whatever the heck you were looking for without you even being involved. That is the exciting part of understanding when you're programming your subconscious. It's not just getting rid of bad programs, but you're actually installing and overriding programs that when you're unconscious, they're going to lead you to successful conclusions and ends in the first place. So this is the necessary step. We must get back into A, knowing how it works enough to allow us to go back in there and to manifest the changes that are relevant. Unfortunately, we don't have the 6 or 7 hours that I would normally take to talk about the more in-depth ways of understanding all this because it involves physics and other kinds of things. But basically, you don't need to know all the details. But when you do know the details, everything works easier because you're coming from a point of knowing rather than a point of hoping. And that's unfortunate because hope itself, some people have programs that squash their hopes, just the way they grew up. So when you know things with science, though, it facilitates the changes because it's like, oh, I got the mechanism. I see how it works. And then the mechanism is allowed to engage more easily. So I encourage that. That's why I go to my website, download articles on things that we've been talking about. They're free articles. Download them on conscious parenting and programming and subconscious mind. And then there's a whole resource section of energy psychology or other body work kinds of things that will also facilitate putting in a new program into the subconscious mind. That's our effort. And when we do that, the reward is that, you know, that honeymoon period, it doesn't have to ever end. The honeymoon period could be a program in the subconscious mind that can carry you. Imagine being on a honeymoon the rest of your life. I've only been on 12 years of it right now, but I'm looking for the rest of it as well because it was a reprogramming of my own belief systems. And now I can honestly say that I am in been living a honeymoon reality for 12 years in a row. And I know that it didn't happen by accident. I sure as heck know it worked by our ability as a couple to identify the subconscious programs that were operating invisibly and sabotaging us as individuals or as couples, and working with them with a dialogue, because most people have trouble with that because when they start talking about another person's behavior, the one that's receiving that information generally puts a protection shield up, and then all of a sudden that dialogue is finished. So it really involves an understanding of both partners know that each of their lives are more or less directed by these unconscious programs, and we don't see them ourselves, then a couple could be educational for each other and supportive of each other of recognizing this without an attack mode or anger or all these other things. Because remember, like I said, training that subconscious mind, when anger is involved, it shuts down. When love and harmony is involved, it's receptive to changing. So there's a lot of information available of what we can do to change this, and the website has a lot of listings as well for people.
Okay, great. Thank you, Bruce. You know, I do have one more question about the physical body.
Yes.
So we talked about pain and chronic conditions, and, you know, obviously we want to reprogram our mind for that. How can this reprogramming or work for, say, you want to lose weight? There are a lot of people that are obese, and we hear things
Absolutely.
Like, oh, I have this weak condition. I can't eat that because...
Right. And then tell me whose minds, see, now again, this is the battle of the minds. The conscious mind is the one that looks in the mirror and decides what the change wants to be. Yeah, but that's the one that only runs the show 5% of the time. That's like me talking to myself about, you're not going to eat that donut, are you? And it's like the subconscious program's got the donut in my mouth before I even see it. And so the issues are, we have a desire to lose weight, conscious mind, but we have programs that have fixed weights in them. And I say this because during your development, weight is an issue of usually protection. and that we put on weight to thicken ourselves, distance ourselves from things that we were sensitive to or afraid of, and so this is a way of protection. Now, the concept about this is that it went into the subconscious mind. It didn't go in with any, like, the discussion with the consciousness. Hey, consciousness, come on in here. What do you think the weight should be? It's like, no, the subconscious mind figured out whatever the abuse was at some particular level, be emotional. It doesn't have to be physical. And in that basis, calculated a weight that said, I need this for my protection. Now, today, your conscious mind says, I don't want it. Yeah, but, like, so what? That mind's running at just a few percent. You want to lose the weight, you have to go back and reprogram. And you're not reprogramming for weight. Weight is the symptom. It's reprogramming for some conflict or some abuse or concern or some negative programming that caused you to get into protective mode. So you're not trying to say, I want to program my mind to have this weight. It's like, I want to program my safety, for example. That's probably an issue in most cases, and that's why we have difficulty, because we're focusing on the wrong thing. A symptom is a reflection. The physical is a reflection of a belief. A thickness is generally connected to thicker means more protection. Okay, a urinary infection. People get urinary infections. Why? They're pissed off. That's basically what it does. Diabetes has to do with sweetness and love and harmony and life, or the lack of it, actually. And what we're beginning to find is, again, we have always blamed these as organic physical illnesses, when we're beginning to find they're almost all lifestyle and complements of the mind's perception of the world manifesting a physical complement to support it.
Wow, that's great. Thank you so much, Bruce.
Appreciate it. I thank everybody for their patience in this long rambling thing that wherever it went, but I think there's probably some good stuff in there somewhere.
Well, you'll both be happy to know that we extended the show another half hour, which we're already 10 minutes into. So if that's okay with you, Bruce.
Let's go for a little bit more, because let's see if there's another question. Maybe now that I know that we're not so totally up against the wall, maybe we can do another question or two.
Okay, well, I don't have anyone on the line at the moment, but I do encourage callers to call in. But the one question I wanted to ask about is where we're emerging into the future. Like, what is this going to mean for the emerging future of holistic practice and healing?
We're in a state of evolution, and civilization is truly ending as we know it, and a new one is forming right under our feet right now.
Mm-hmm.
And you say, well, what are you saying? That's just because of all these crises. And I say, no, there's a reason. And the reason is based on this. Remember, beliefs shape our lives. And the beliefs that we hold as a culture shape the character of a culture. And when the beliefs that shape a culture change, by definition, the culture changes when those beliefs change. So when we go back, we could talk about in Western civilization, there have been civilizations that have come and gone. And you say, well, why do they come and go? Because civilizations have a life cycle. And they come when they provide information and awareness that encourages life and growth at that time. And then they crash, usually when they become so rigid in their beliefs, they can't accommodate the changes, which are just characteristic of a dynamic universe. So I could say the kinds of civilizations, well, in the West, we had like animism, which was like our Native Americans or the Druids in England, where these were earth people and everything was spiritual and earthbound. And then we went to polytheism, which was a completely different set of beliefs that provided for the religions with different gods, like the Egyptians, the Greeks, the Romans, and all that, where they took spirit out of things and put them into gods. And then we went into a civilization called monotheism, where a civilization was run by the church, where they put all the spirit into one thing and sent it off the planet, so there's no spirit on the planet at all. And then that ultimately corrupted civilization, and new truths came in. But the new truths came from science and things like Darwin's work. And then these truths came in, and culture adapted to the new truth. Now, let me tell you, I'll specifically tell you where these truths apply. There are three fundamental questions that humans have asked since the dawn of time. And these questions are actually called the perennial questions. And they are, how did we get here? Why are we here? And now that we're here, how do we make the best of it?
Mm-hmm.
Now, here's a fact of history. Whoever provides answers to those questions that the population accepts as a group, that entity or that organization becomes the truth provider for that particular civilization. So we'll go back to the last one. That was monotheism. The church-ran civilization. They answered the questions. How did we get here? Divine intervention. Why are we here? To live out plays of morality, to see if we can go off planet to that, wherever that spirit got sent to go there. And how do you live here? Well, you live according to the rules of the scripture, the Bible, whatever it is. So basically, we accepted that as a population. The church then also became the truth provider for all the other truths. So whatever truth they said about life, we bought that, and the culture ran on that truth. I mean, think about it. There was a truth that women could be witches and that they had the devil in them, and that if you go and burn them, they will like that because that will get the devil out of them. And so the fact was witch burnings end up being a family event and a community event. Why? Because that was what the culture's truth was. I mean, imagine that today. Hey, let's go down and burn somebody. It's like, what? But at that time, that was truth. That was life. Science comes in, changes the truth, said, no, we didn't get here through Genesis story. We got here through random evolution. Why are we here? Well, there's no reason for it because it was random evolution, so there's no purpose. But how do you live here? And the answer is to survive the struggle, be the fittest in the survival for existence.
Right.
And so our world is based on what? Well, we have no real purpose, but we're here to fight it out in a dog-eat-dog world and to survive. You're going to go to work every damn day because you don't want to be the one at the end that's the dead one. And so we live in a competition-based world on our list, which is based on material. So how do you know if you're successful? How many Humvees do you have, et cetera, et cetera? So the issue about all that is that we've been living the wrong dream because the new science has now come in. And the new science says it's not the material world that's primal, it's the invisible world. Spiritual world is more primal than the physical world. So that changes that belief. The belief that genes control us goes away. No, our mind controls us. Evolution is not based on competition. It is now recognized that evolution is based on cooperation. And this is why this new evolution, we're cooperating together in a way we've never done before because it's the only way out. So the foundational beliefs that we've been living by, competition, a collection of material stuff and all that, is giving way to a world based on community, cooperation, and the raising to higher levels of non-tangible things such as happiness and love and joy versus Humvees and diamond watches and things, all these things, we're moving out of one into another. And so there's the ending of the current structure and the development of a civilization that will support us in a world based on harmony and community and health and happiness and returning the garden back to the planet. So we're in that crux right now, and the next few years are the big crisis years where chaos ensues, and maybe 2012, as everyone is beginning to believe, which will enforce its reality, will be the transformation. But you don't get that transformation until the chaos, and that's what we're going through right now. So you can focus on the chaos or focus on the transformation, and that's the difference between those that are scared and those that are hopeful at this point.
Well, it's evident for those, and obviously in your case as well, as how you've evolved, but I know many of the people in the healing practices now, the holistic healing practices and a lot of the energy work, I mean, this was an actual calling, just like I guess it was for you. It wasn't a spontaneous mind thing. It came through you and it flowed through you. So we're seeing this, emerge everywhere around us.
And exactly. And that's what the new book, Spontaneous Evolution, is really all about. So it's really a guide map. It's a guide map saying why it's happening and what the ultimate resolution is because of concepts called fractals, which we don't have time to go into. In fact, I actually have to really shorten this because I realize I'm overstepping another appointment.
Oh, my goodness. Oh,
I'm
so sorry.
About that. But we got some extra time.
We do?
We did.
Oh, we did get it. Yes, we did. Well, you know what? We all do, and it's going to be wonderful. Thank you so much, and I'm sorry to have kept you.
Oh, no, that's great, because everything we can get out, and maybe there's some hope. That's what the whole idea is. So
I know there's hope. That's what I'm looking forward to.
So thank you, Suzanne. Thank you, everybody out there that's listened to this, and I hope some of it was fun, like I think it can be.
Oh, well, you're dynamic and fun, and I wish you, and I want to thank you, because you're just incredible in your contribution. So thank you so much, Bruce.
Okay, thank you.
And we hope to see you again soon.
I hope so. Thank you so much, Suzanne Cruz.
All right.
Bye-bye.
Take care. Bye-bye. Oh, listeners, I am just, I'm bubbling with energy over here. I don't know about all of you, but I really loved spending time with all of you in the chat room tonight and with Bruce. And just to let you know, next week on our regular Sunday show at 6 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, we're going to be journeying with George Haas, H-A-A-S. And George was an artist who actually went through a bunch of NASA photographs and found some pretty incredible eye-opening discoveries on the planet Mars that are linking us to our ancient cultures here on Earth, which is going to be really, really a fantastic journey to take. So I encourage you all, and we'll be followed with Jill Bolt Taylor and My Stroke of Insight. So I'm really excited about the guests we'll be able to bring with you, and I honor your presence, all of you, and all the love that you share and the support that you offer us. And, you know, hopefully we could just keep this thing rolling and just keep building the momentum. Okay, and anybody who's on Twitter, please tweet while you're on the show. We want to try to get as many people on this this wagon of truth and heading towards higher consciousness, higher frequency, higher vibration, and actually taking inspired action to this whole new emergence, you know, of who we are and who we can become. So I honor you all again, and thank you so much for joining us. And let's see. Oh, I feel bad just leaving the show with all this time left over. We have like 13 minutes. Anybody care like for staying and chatting more? How about somebody calling in and let's have a little conversation about what we just heard? Is there anybody that would like to do that? Acknowledge in the chat. Come on, Louise. Come and give me a call. All right, it doesn't look like anybody's going to be calling. So, and I'm sure we've all had our fill tonight. So thank you again, everyone, for joining us. And we'll see you next time on Wisdom Wide Open Radio. And remember to find the joy in enjoying your journey. Bye-bye, everyone.